This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. And we are waiting right now for President Obama, who is expected to make a statement any minute now from the White House. And joining us to talk about that right now from Washington is NPR's Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor. Also from Erbil, Iraq, we're joined by NPR international correspondent Deborah Amos. And Tom Bowman is with us. He's NPR Pentagon reporter. He's in Washington. Ron, let me go first to you. What are we expecting from the president?
We're expecting the president to address some of these demands that the United States act in the emerging civil war situation in Iraq. Whether or not he is going to talk about airstrikes, we don't know for sure, but it seems unlikely. We have been told that he might bring a proposal for some Green Berets or other ground forces to be inserted in addition to the people who have already been sent to provide embassy security. There is the chance that these people would just be going in as advisors or trainers, but those who have been listening to such terms over the last 30, 40 years know where that can lead. So this is fraught with a lot of political consequences for the president, for the country.
And Ron, we mentioned this fraught language of advisors going in, perhaps 100. These are early reports. Of course, we'll listen and find out as we watch pictures of the empty podium at the White House. But just remind us more about why that is so fraught, that thought of just advisors going in.
Well, 50 years ago in the 60s, President Kennedy, continuing a policy of President Eisenhower, supported some degree of assistance to a country in Asia called South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. That no longer exists because it became Vietnam after the end of the Vietnam War, which dragged on for more than a decade, took more than 50,000 American lives, took untold numbers of Southeast Asian lives. And the United States' enormous commitment to that war, which eventually involved millions of American soldiers, not all at once, but over a sequence of years, roughly 500,000 at a time at the peak of that war, that commitment began with some advisors and some trainers. And people remember that. People also remember how other engagements around the world have led in largely the same direction. So we have been to Iraq. We have been in this war. We have had six-figure commitments of troops in this war over the past 10 years. We got out in 2011, and at that time the promise was we were not going back in. And you hear people continually saying in Washington, no boots on the ground. It's a cliche now. It's almost lost its meaning because it's said so often. So any number of troops that could be characterized as combat troops or combat-ready troops, even if their role is to be trainers, even if their role is to be advisors, that's going to look dangerous to an awful lot of people with memories here in Washington.
Let me bring in Deborah Amos, who is joining us from Erbil, Iraq. Deborah, as we wait for the president to speak here, your thoughts and what this means for Iraq, if indeed he is going to send in, Robin and Ron were talking about, 100 Green Berets.
You know, I think that we heard from an interesting and influential voice today in a speech in London, General David Petraeus, who, if you remember, was in Mosul in the beginning of this war. He said, you have to watch out. You cannot be the Air Force for the Shia interests in Iraq. He was saying, don't take sides. Do not be pulled in on one side or the other. And I think that that will be a very interesting thing to watch here. This is a sectarian war. This is a country that is on the verge of a huge divide. So for the Americans to be seen to be taking a huge role on one side of that war without addressing the political disenfranchisement of a huge part of this population, that is also fraught. So it's a very tricky policy to pull off, and we'll see what the president is talking about, I suppose, in a few minutes.
Deb Amos, you remind us that it was General Petraeus who encouraged the Sunnis, the more moderate Sunnis, to rise up themselves and, in a counterterrorism, take on the militant Sunnis. As he said, he put that in their hands. But I just want to go to Tom Bowman for a second, again, our NPR Pentagon reporter in Washington. Tom, what do you think happened here? What happened between yesterday and today, either in Iraq or in talks in Washington behind these closed doors, to obviously cause some action on the part of the president?
Well, first of all, there's real concern about the ISIS militants. Will they move south toward Baghdad? That's one big concern. They're taking over all sorts of areas now. The Iraqi forces appear to be pushing them back, but they're very stubborn, and they're starting to slip into other areas as well. So that's the first big concern, sort of how do you put out this grass fire for openers? And there's also the political part of this, too. I talked to a senior official last night who said, listen, this administration is souring on Maliki. They would like to see him go. If that's the case, how do you push him out? He's been elected by his people. And who replaces him? And, you know, if the Americans push out this leader and push for him to be replaced by somebody else, you know, what kind of standing would that person have in his own community? So it's really a mess. I just talked to about six or eight Iraq, you know, experts, some military, some civilian, and almost all of them mentioned civil war, partition, and they all said this is probably going to get worse before it gets better. But Deb's right. The underlying problem here is a political one. Maliki has been operating as a Shiite dictator. He's not reaching out to the Sunni community or the Kurdish community. I understand Vice President Joe Biden has been reaching out to the tribal sheikhs in Anbar province that were part of that awakening. But what's he going to say to them? They've been pressuring Maliki for years now to be more inclusive, and he has not.
If you're just joining us, we're waiting for President Obama to make a statement on the crisis in Iraq from the White House. This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jeremy Hobson along with Robin Young here in Boston. We've got with us Ron Elving in Washington, Deborah Amos in Erbil, Iraq, and Tom Bowman in Washington as well. Tom, is the president looking at this as at ISIS, that is, as a threat to the United States or just to the stability of Iraq?
Both. The Director of National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, has already said that ISIS poses a threat to the homeland. He was talking about them in Syria, but now it's more of a threat as they move into Iraq and have taken up territory in the north. So it's clearly a bigger threat now, one would think, now that they have basically this huge swath of Sunni territory. And again, some of these experts I was talking with say now that there is no border now between Syria and Iraq. That is gone. And you may be seeing now some hardening of the lines between the three major groups in Iraq, the Sunnis, the Kurds, and the Shia. So, you know, Iraq may be over as we know it as a unified country, if it ever was one.
I want to ask Deb about that. But first, just to pick up on the political, Tom, because you mentioned there are political considerations in Iraq, you know, with President Maliki and whether the U.S. can force him out. But Ron Elving, what are the political considerations at home? Yesterday, there was this flurry of activity with former Vice President Dick Cheney writing that op-ed in The Wall Street Journal, eviscerating President Obama's policy in Iraq, causing huge uproar in Washington. Is that a separate issue, or was that just a line too far that Cheney wrote about Obama making these huge mistakes? And is the White House reacting to that as well?
It's impossible for the White House to ignore something like that attack that was written by the former vice president and his daughter, Liz. That has gotten a great deal of attention. It was provocative. It distilled, if you will, all the criticism that we have heard from what is sometimes called the war party within Congress. It features John McCain, the man that Barack Obama defeated for president in 2008, also Lindsey Graham and some other members of the Senate, who have given extensive speeches, including this morning, deriding the administration for dithering, for fiddling while Iraq burns, to quote Senator McCain just this morning. And really making the point that everything would have been better if we had left more troops in Iraq in 2011, that it was not a mistake to go into Iraq back in 2003, as was a policy of Dick Cheney's own administration with President George W. Bush, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, a number of the people who were household names 10 years ago when we went into Iraq, all said that this was going to be a highly successful invasion, that we would be greeted as liberators, that Iraq would become a model for the Middle East and for the world in general for moving forward. And none of that happened. And what has happened instead is the chaos and the struggle that we have seen over the last 10 years, which was somewhat abated in the years immediately after 2007. General Petraeus was involved, and we changed strategies, and the war settled down for a while, if you will. The civil war cooled off for a while. And then in 2011, we felt we were secure enough to leave and to leave the country to its own leaders. And those leaders have now led it directly back into the worst cauldron of the civil war.
And if I could just pick up on that, Robin, you know, you do hear from retired military people, active duty military people, it was a mistake for the U.S. to leave Iraq in 2011. The Obama administration should have worked harder for some sort of agreement, should have kept 10 to 20,000 troops there, mostly training and so forth. But then you talk to others who say, well, hang on a second. You know, the U.S. had no leverage when it had 100,000 troops here, 150,000 troops with Maliki.
Right.
And I spoke 2 years ago with a senior officer who just returned from Baghdad, and he was pressing Maliki again to be more inclusive. And Maliki basically brushed this guy aside and said, I think I know what I'm doing in my own country.
We remember there were other issues as well. The Maliki and the Iraq government would not grant immunity to U.S. troops there. There was a lot of friction there. And we're also reminded that it was President Bush who originally said that the timeline would be quick and efficient, that U.S. troops would leave.
Signed that status of forces agreement with Maliki.
Yeah, yeah.
Deb Amos?
For a minute to 2011, which was an election that Maliki didn't win, but he came out on top as the prime minister. He was backed by the Iranians. He put his foot down on the status of forces agreement. It was impossible for the Americans to force him to sign. He did not want to. The Iranians said no. So to revisit history and say that we could have made him is not quite accurate. I think 2010 may be the moment that brings us to here. Maliki becomes prime minister, stays for another four years, and he also prevails in this election. It doesn't necessarily mean that he has to be the prime minister. This has not been decided yet. There's been an election. His party did well, but in the way that Iraqi politics works, he doesn't have to be. It's a negotiation over the prime ministership. He doesn't automatically win it. He has the ability to form a government, but it is possible for the political class of Baghdad to choose somebody else.
But is there somebody else who would meet the requirements of the Obama administration, somebody who could bring these parties together?
What about Alawi?
Yes, There is Alawi, there's Adel Abdel Mahdi, there are many figures, not many, but there are national figures who have been more inclusive in their politics, have reached out to Sunnis, to Kurds, in a way that Maliki has not. This is not a country that is missing political leaders. There may even be too many of them. But I think that this has been a shock to the political class of Baghdad, and I'm sure that they are also mulling who else besides Maliki. And that discussion, I am sure, is going on in Baghdad now.
If you're just joining us, we're waiting for President Obama to come out and make a statement on Iraq. We're speaking there with Deborah Amos, who is in Erbil, Iraq, NPR international correspondent. We've also got with us Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor, and Tom Bowman, NPR's Pentagon reporter, also in Washington. I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young. And Robin, as usual with these things, they don't start on time.
Well,
President Obama said 12:30. It's now 12:43.
It's an important moment, and I'm sure he wants to get it right. But the speculation, again, if you're just joining us, the speculation this morning, late morning reports came that the president is expected to make a statement about perhaps sending as many as 100 Green Berets as advisors to Iraq. There have already been troops sent to protect the embassy, and that's, of course, sparked a lot of concern about what exactly that means. I want to just stay with Deborah Amos there in Erbil. Again, this is in the Kurdish semi-autonomous region of Iraq. Deborah, just something that Tom Bowman said a little bit ago, again, our Pentagon reporter with an eye on all of this, that we may be looking at the end of Iraq. That's pretty chilling. There where you are in the Kurdish region, many Kurds are hoping to pick up some of the pieces here. You know, they've always wanted more autonomy. But how are people there reacting to this moment in time?
Well, they are watching a failed state in the rest of Iraq. In a peculiar and ironic moment of history, they are coming out the winners. They were able to take the city of Kirkuk, which is down the road. It has always been disputed, but in Kurdish history and certainly in Kurdish emotions, that has always been seen as the capital of Kurdistan, an independent Kurdistan. The Kurds are now in that town, and they did it because they were the only force that could move ISIS, the Islamist militants, away from Kirkuk. It is very unlikely that they will leave that city. And so they have tightened their borders. They have taken in thousands of people who were fleeing Mosul, but they have tightened over the last couple of days. It's very difficult to get here. There are camps on the other side of the line with Kurdistan here, and you see many Arabs from Mosul who are there with their families. But unless they can go through a security check with the Peshmerga forces, which is the army here, unless they can pass a security check, they're not coming in. And so I think that the Kurds are watching what's happening in the rest of the country and saying, look, we are in very good shape here. It's very safe here. You know, there's businesses open, five-star hotels. The Kurds have oil now, negotiating with the Turks to sell it against Baghdad's wishes. It hasn't happened yet. So they see themselves as the winner as the rest of the state collapses.
Yeah, that's NPR's international correspondent Deborah Amos in Erbil in Iraq. We've also got Ron Elving on the line, our senior Washington editor, and Pentagon reporter Tom Bowman, both in Washington. We have other guests lined up because we are just getting word, Jeremy Hobson, that President Obama, who is expected to speak at about 12:30 East Coast time, is now going to speak at about 1:15.
Right, and we'll continue about a half an hour from now.
We'll continue to bring you anticipation of that speech as we wait for him to come, because this is Ron Elving and Tom Bowman, one of you jump at this, you tell me, this feels like an important moment.
It's a point of inflection, let's put it that way. The president has been brought to this moment by events that are in some sense of his making, in a larger sense, not of his making. When he came to the presidency, elected in 2008, he was famously against the involvement in Iraq. He had opposed it from the beginning. It was part of the reason he was able to outflank Hillary Clinton in 2002, 2007, 2008, and become the Democratic nominee and win the presidency. And so he came to office calling Iraq an example of, quote, dumb wars,
right?
The kind of wars we didn't want to fight, the kind of wars we needn't fight. And he was interested in getting out as quickly as possible, and they were able to do that in 2011 when they felt safe enough to do it. So now we're at the point where the worst-case scenario of that pullout in 2011 is unfolding before us with negative consequences for Iraq and for ourselves as well.
Well, and Tom,
go ahead. Ron, this is an inflection here that even if he goes out and says, we're going to send 100 Green Berets in, and we don't know, first of all, if they'll be sent or what they'll be doing. Presumably, they could do some sort of training. They could be in the National Military Command Center looking at the terminals, the feeds from the drones, which already have been sent to Iraq to help them pinpoint some of these ISIS militants. So even if they do send 100 in, it's not really a big deal. They're clearly not going to push back ISIS, which is moving in throughout the northern part and the central part of the country. And we also know that we heard this yesterday in testimony. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Martin Dempsey, said the Iraqi leaders have asked for airstrikes by the U.S. And General Dempsey said, well, that's kind of difficult to do. First of all, what are the targets? What do you hit? You have a group of 5,000 or so fighters that moved into Mosul that used to be a city of 2 million. They're in among the population. They don't have any armor or long columns that you could hit at this point. And also, you know, experts, military experts I spoke with say, listen, even if you want to do airstrikes, even if you had targets, you need people on the ground that can call in those airstrikes, combat air controllers. And there are no combat air controllers from the U.S. that you could use at this point that could either call in coordinates for these airstrikes or laze the targets, you know, so you could hit them. So, again, you know, this is really only an inflection, I would say. And getting back to the political part of this, that's the underlying issue here, the political failures of the Maliki government. And how do you move ahead on that issue?
Let's bring in another guest that we've got with us. Joining us now is General Robert Scales, who's a retired U.S. Army Major General and former Commandant of the U.S. Army War College. General Scales, what if President Obama announces that he's going to send in 100 Green Berets to help train Iraqi forces? Would that do enough in your view?
No, it won't do very much. much. Just so you know, this 100 or so are going to be senior NCOs and mid-level officers from the Army, principally from Fort Bragg. They're going to be split up and distributed, some inside the Green Zone, but mostly with Iraqi brigade headquarters that are sprinkled north and west of Baghdad. And their purpose is threefold. Number one is to help advise brigade commanders on how to defend the city. Second, to act as a bridge with ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, as your guests just said. And third, standing by if they have to be a facilitator for the delivery of airstrikes. But from all I've been told, airstrikes simply are off the table because they won't be effective because the ISIS is in the cities and you can't bomb cities without killing civilians.
Well, General Scales, Robin here, we're just hearing from both Ron Elving and Tom Bowman that they both felt this was an inflection point. And you guys, I looked it up because I wanted to make sure. Sure, what that meant, and it's sort of a significant change in the progress of a country, let's say, or a geopolitical situation, and it could be a turning point after which there's a dramatic change.
No.
What do you think?
No, it's not an inflection point. It's a bump. It's not. I disagree with my good friends from NPR. There's just not enough. Given the size of what's happening and the magnitude of what's happening, putting 100 Green Berets, unless it's just a nose under the tent, is going to have little or no effect on conditions.
Well, hold on a second, Tom Bowman. I'm not sure you meant just the announcement of the troops. Did you mean this whole moment in time?
Well, you know, again, I think the administration is trying to grapple with how to handle this and handle two things: how do you roll back ISIS, and how do you deal with the underlying political issues as well. I think that's where the administration is right now. And, you know, I agree that, you know, sending in 100 is not going to really do that much. They may go out work with the Iraqi forces. But, again, it's ISIS at this point is pretty much entrenched in some of those cities, in Mosul, and moving on Samarra, and moving on Balad and Fallujah. I guess they haven't taken that city maybe, but they certainly are making inroads there. So how do you push them out, and who will push them out? Will it be the Iraqi forces, or will, again, we just sort of throw our hands up and basically say, this country is split into thirds?
I agree with the general that 100 additional Americans in Iraq will not make a difference to the combat situation on the ground there. It probably is something that is more of a gesture than anything else. The inflection that I see, and I think Tom might have been referring to as well, is in the attitude of the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. They have really shelved Iraq over the last 3 years. They've really tried to refocus American policy on Afghanistan and on domestic issues. They have not wanted Iraq to consume as much of their presidency as it consumed of the George W. Bush presidency. At this point, they have been forced to pivot. They have been forced to change their attitude towards this particular part of the world, and it is again a major priority for them, at least for the moment, at least until we can see where this particular situation is going. That's the inflection.
Well, and Deb Amos, let me bring you back in Erbil, Iraq. How did the Obama administration miss this rise of ISIS so quickly?
I don't know. I can't answer that. I'm not in Washington. We have been watching the rise of ISIS covering the Syrian revolt. They have been in charge of a city of 1 million in Raqqa for more than a year. And so it's not a surprise. These were Iraqis in the first place. It's where they came from, and now they've come home. But I think it would be a mistake to see what has happened in the Sunni heartland in northern Iraq as a monolithic group. It is not just ISIS out there, and that is what is so interesting and has been revealed to all of us who have come to Erbil to cover this, that this is maybe 15 groups who are out there. ISIS may be the smallest of them. These are disgruntled Sunnis. They are ex-Baathist military officers, which may explain why they have been so successful militarily. They do understand command and control. These are trained commanders who are out there giving the army under Prime Minister Maliki a run for their money. And when you watch how they take a town, this is not a guerrilla band. They, for example, in Tal Afar, they came in from four separate locations. And so I think we will know as time goes on exactly who is out there. But each time they get to a new town, it's not that they come in with thousands. They have people in those towns who are willing to rise up. It's how they were able to so quickly take to Crete and then Beji, surround the town where the country's largest oil refinery is. And now they are surrounding the oil refinery and may take it.
Lynn, don't we understand?
Could I just jump in there for a second?
Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
You were asking, you know, how was this missed, you know, by the Obama administration? Well, back in February, in testimony on the Hill, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, said in testimony that he expected ISIS to take portions of both Syria and Iraq in 2014. Again, this is back in February. So the question is not only what the Obama administration do or not do, what did Congress do with this information? Did anybody say this is a concern or, my goodness, how can that happen? So they did have the information. The question is, across the board in Washington, why didn't anybody do anything about it?
That's Tom Bowman, NPR's Pentagon reporter. We just heard from Deb Amos, our international correspondent in Iraq. Ron Elving's in Washington as well, our senior Washington editor. And we've also got General Robert Scales, retired U.S. Army Major General and former commandant of the U.S. Army War College, on the line a couple minutes before the hour as we wait for President Obama to speak now at 1:15 East Coast time.
And we were expecting him to speak at 12:30. Then the word came from Washington that he will be speaking at 1:15 East Coast time, and the expectation is that he is going to announce some kind of increased U.S. role in the crisis that is ongoing in Iraq. Ron, we've just got about a minute and a half left before we've got to go to break as we continue to follow this. But your thoughts as we wait for the president.
This is something that was perhaps the worst nightmare for this administration when they succeeded in getting U.S. commitment out of Iraq in terms of ground troops. They obviously hoped that Maliki would be more successful in reaching out, that he would do more with the Sunnis and the Kurds. They did not have a great deal of leverage, however, to force him to do so. And clearly the pressures that he is responding to here are the internal pressures of his own Sunni community, his own Shiite community that he's responsive to. He is a Shiite. And he has the backing of another client entirely, and that is Iran, which is a Shiite nation, and which is very interested in getting involved here in order to defend some of the Shia shrines in Iraq. And they are, at this point, the most practical alternative that Maliki has.
And General Scales, first of all, we hope you can stay with us. But one last question to you. Who, in this hour, who is President Obama speaking to today? Is it to us? Is it to Maliki?
I think it's to both. I think Maliki is the biggest stumbling block to any ability for the United States to provide serious aid to the Iraqis. I think the Joint Chiefs of Staff steadfast in that. They said they cannot reinforce failure. As long as Maliki is in charge, the army will never be effective enough, and you couldn't put enough U.S. troops on the ground to turn this around without some type of significant reform in the Iraqi army. There are plenty of very talented officers in the Iraqi army that we train. Sadly, they've all been displaced by mostly corrupt Shia officers.
Well, and many of the former Iraqi army officers have now joined ISIS, as that army was disbanded years ago. We're going to have to wrap it up there. We're asking you all to stand by. Jeremy?
As we continue to wait for President Obama, who is expected at 1:15 Eastern time today. And Robin, you talked about who's watching this. There are probably also people watching this in Iran, in Saudi Arabia, and all around the world. President Obama, will be speaking in about 15 minutes. This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young, and we are waiting for President Obama to make a much-anticipated statement on Iraq. He was originally supposed to make a statement at about 12:30 East Coast time. It's now been moved to about 1:15, about 7-8 minutes from now. A statement that could have a huge importance. There's expectation that the president might be announcing that 100 Green Berets will be going to Iraq as advisors. He also might push to move Prime Minister Maliki from office in Iraq. So we are waiting his thoughts. We've been waiting with Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor, in Erbil, Iraq, NPR international correspondent Deborah Amos, and Tom Bowman, who's NPR Pentagon reporter. He is in Washington, D.C. And also joining us in the studio is Jim Walsh. He's an expert in international security at MIT's Security Studies Program. And Jim, I just want to start with you. Your expectation and your thoughts about these words coming up in maybe 8 minutes from the president.
My guess is the president's going to try to reassure the American public. You know, this has caused a lot of concern. There's some big talk about big consequences of what's happening there. So the first thing is to communicate, I'm on top of this, and then to try to outline what his strategy is and the rationale for that strategy so people understand why he's making the decisions he's making. But I don't expect a big announcement that suggests that there are going to be large numbers of American forces getting involved here.
Mm-hmm. Tom Bowman, NPR Pentagon reporter, let me ask you this. What are the pressures on both sides for the president? Those who are saying, don't do anything, this is not our problem, and those who are saying, you need to get involved?
Well, I think he's probably going to have a middle course here, provide some advisors over there. Again, they've already provided additional drone coverage, surveillance coverage, and you could see more of that for the Iraqi government. But you know, clearly they're not going to send large numbers of forces, and I think they believe that they have to do something at this point. You know, not large numbers of forces.
And Deb, you're there in Erbil. Again, this is the relatively calm city in the Kurdish semi-autonomous region of Iraq. The upset with the Sunni militants has been south of Erbil. Again, these militants are outside of Baghdad, maybe 40 miles outside of Baghdad. But are people there watching this? Is this something they are also watching and waiting for?
Oh, yeah, and people here are talking about it, and there's some very practical problems because of this crisis. In particular, there are huge gas lines here. As you know, ISIS militants have surrounded the country's largest oil refiner at Beji.
Yeah. Well, but actually, Deb, I meant you're right. Of course, they're watching the crisis, but are they also anticipating President Obama's words? I don't even know if you have a TV set you can turn on there. I don't know.
Oh yes. Yeah. Plenty of TV sets here.
I meant where you are.
Probably more channels than you do.
But people are waiting.
I think that yes, it will certainly make all the newscasts, as everything has here, and you know, people are awash in news. There are many, many outlets here, so people are waiting for the president. But look, this is an Iraqi problem, and they know it here in Kurdistan. It is a political problem, so they are much more watching what happens in Baghdad. Mm. Is there going to be any change in the political leadership there? Is there going to be change in the kind of political discourse that we've had over the past couple of days, where, you know, Maliki is still talking in sort of that old way of, calling on Shias to come. There was an announcement today calling on any volunteer that wanted to join the army. You know, this gets into very unpleasant sectarian overshadowing for this conflict, which, of course, you know, is part of the problem here. So people are watching Baghdad as much as they're watching Washington.
Deb, I remember being in Turkey, just outside of Iraq, in the lead up to the Iraq War in 2003, with many of the Kurdish leaders who soon took power in Iraq, and they were being very pro-war. They wanted the U.S. to get involved. How do the Kurds feel now about potential U.S. involvement today?
Well, I have a colleague here who spoke to a Kurdish official, and he asked him directly, would you allow the U.S. to base here for any strikes into Iraq? And he said, absolutely not. This gets us nowhere. It gets us on the enemy's list for ISIS and for retaliation. And this would not be good for the Kurdish people. We are safe here. We can protect our borders as they are. This is a mess that is happening in the rest of Iraq. And I think that they also understand how complicated it is that airstrikes
are not what's called for here. It's almost impossible to think how that would work. So many of the refugees that have come or tried to get into Kurdistan left Mosul not because they were afraid of ISIS, but because they were afraid of government airstrikes in retaliation. And that's why they've been leaving. So far, the reports that we're getting from Mosul is things are relatively quiet there. There's no electricity and water is a problem. But in terms of violence on the street, there isn't any.
NPR's Deborah Amos there in Erbil in Iraq. And we've just got a couple of minutes before the president is supposed to speak. So, Ron Elving, I just want to ask you, for those who've just joined us, I may have to interrupt you, but just briefly, what is the expectation of what the president is going to say?
The president is going to articulate the American interest in Iraq at this point and the capability that we might have to affect the situation. He is apparently going to talk about sending in 100 Green Berets. That is what we've been told. And there is also speculation that there might be some increased diplomatic moves. One thing that has been talked about is the possibility that Secretary of State John Kerry would be sent in to talk personally to the leader of Iraq, to Maliki, and to say, look, you really have to consider that you have become the problem here. We can't push you out of office, but perhaps a resignation here could help everyone in this critical moment. And then the United States might have more leverage to actually affect the situation, make the situation better, either through further diplomatic efforts or through some sort of military intervention. But we don't want to get involved further backing the man we see as having caused this entire situation to sour. So that would be another diplomatic move that the president could announce this afternoon.
NPR's Ron Elving in Washington. As we wait here, this is a special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jeremy Hobson along with Robin Young here in Boston, and we're waiting for President Obama to speak about Iraq. And I just, as we wait, want to bring in one more voice here, Derek Harvey, who's director of the Global Initiative at the University of South Florida. He served as General David Petraeus' senior intelligence and policy advisor from 2007 to 2008 in Iraq and then in Central Command Headquarters in 2009 and 2010. Derek Harvey, your thoughts as we wait for President Obama.
Well, I'm hoping that I'll be able to see and hear from the president a strategy and a policy direction that will address our core interests in Iraq and the concern that we have about spillover from Iraq affecting stability more broadly in the region, not just into Syria, but also affecting eventually Jordan and the Gulf region. If we do not address some of the core issues in Iraq and contain this problem, there are significant concerns about Iraq breaking up into potentially four different parts and the growth and influence and capability of this organization, ISIS, expanding dramatically with dire consequences for us in the region.
Well, interesting, Derek. Deb Amos told us that earlier today your former boss, David Petraeus, spoke in London and reminded people that he felt that the U.S. can't side with one side. And Tom Bowman, just your thoughts on that. Again, you're a Pentagon reporter. This idea of sending Green Berets to help the government forces in Iraq is siding, in effect, with the Sunnis.
With the Shiites.
I'm sorry, with the Shiites, that's what I meant. Against the Sunni militants, yeah.
Well, I think the issue is they're going to try to straddle it. On the one hand, they have to stop ISIS from moving south to Baghdad. On the other hand, they have to push Maliki to do what needs to be done and what they've been pressing him to do for years now, be more inclusive, be sort of the Mandela of Iraq. So far, that hasn't happened. And if John Kerry is sent to Iraq, can he deliver that message and will Maliki listen?
We are awaiting the president. He is expected to speak any minute now about Iraq. There's a podium that we're all watching. It's kind of empty, and he should be coming out any minute now to make a statement on Iraq. We've got many people with us to digest it afterwards. Deborah Amos there in Iraq, Tom Bowman, Pentagon reporter in D.C., Jim Walsh, expert in international security at MIT Security Studies Program. He's here with us in the studios. Derek Harvey, again, director of the Global Initiative at the University of South Florida, and someone who served with General Petraeus.
And Jim Walsh, how concerned are you at this point about what's happening in Iraq spilling over, as Derek was saying, into other parts of the region?
Well, I definitely think that's a possibility, and it's a possibility whether ISIS has turned back or not. I mean, I think our experience in the region is that extremists are highly mobile. When Gaddafi fell, they moved to Mali. When they experienced defeats elsewhere, they moved to where their next best action is. And so, you know, we may be able to push them back. We may be able to contain them, but they're not going to disappear. They will find shelter elsewhere. The other thing I would say quickly is at the end of the day, and Derek touched on this, we need a strategy. Right now, the sort of thing is, this is bad. We need to do something about it. But that's not enough. You have to have an objective. You have to figure out what you're willing to pay to achieve that objective. And you have to have some sense of what's the probability of success and how long it's going to take. And I'm not hearing that so far in the discussion.
How important for ISIS would control over this? Looks like we're getting a two-minute warning or something like that. Yeah. How important for ISIS would be the control of this Iraqi oil refinery, Jim?
Well, I think it's certainly an asset. Everyone wants an oil refinery, and I think it would be an asset and give them some leverage. And it would be part of an economic piece of trying to put together what would be a sub-state or a state within a state. So that's why I think the Iraqi army is fighting so hard to try to retake it.
Well, Deb Amos, again, while we are waiting, what are people saying there in Iraq about this battle over the oil refinery?
Well, it is a key battle because the other speakers are absolutely right. It's an economic piece for them. Now, Mosul, a city of 2 million, has no electricity. Maybe a half hour came on sometime today. Mm-hmm. So they need that refinery for cooking oil, for gas. We've already got big gas lines up here because Beji's been offline for a couple of days now. What we are hearing from some calls we've been able to make to Beji is that there's negotiations going on, that there are cell phone calls between the ISIS people who are surrounding Beji and the security forces who are inside. What's always interesting to me is everybody knows everybody here, and yeah. You really can call up.
So it's sort of a thin line between the militants who are trying to take over the oil refinery and the security forces trying to defend it. They may even know each other.
They may.
Yeah. Okay. Again, it's about 18 minutes past the hour, and we are waiting for President Obama to make a statement on Iraq. A lot of expectation and an important statement, so I'm sure he wants to get it right. But lucky for us, we have a lot of people with a lot of things to say about this situation there. Ron Elving, who do you think is included in this backroom discussion? Do you think the president has reached out to the other side of the aisle as he shapes this?
Or to former presidents,
yeah,
even.
Yeah. What do you think's, you know, it's speculation, but what do you think's going on here?
There are a number of people that the president would want to have involved beyond the National Security Council itself. His National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, certainly John Kerry, whom we mentioned a moment ago, is a possible emissary to go to Iraq in the days ahead and see if he can make a difference. Possibly ex-president, certainly Bill Clinton would be a likely one for him to talk to. He might also contact other former presidents, perhaps George H.W. Bush, whose own experience with Iraq was instructive and who made very different decisions in that country than his son made when his son was president. So that would be another possibility. It is also possible that lower-level people, not necessarily at the very top echelons of the George W. Bush White House, would be of use, people who worked in the State Department, people in the military. David Petraeus, for example, whom we've already discussed, has obviously had some insight into this and said a lot of things that made a lot of sense in the last couple of days. So that would be another person for the president to reach out to. He had reached out to him before, and he had a job in the first Obama term. So a number of people, as many people as possible, but in the end, the president has to bring all that together, distill it all, and say, this is the way we're going to move.
Well, and Derek Harvey, just as we wait for the president, and I may have to cut you off as he comes out, but what would a strategy be that you would think would do the job in Iraq?
Well, I think at the beginning, we need to think about going after ISIS and providing some tailored, effective military support to reinforce the Iraqi security forces, and we can hit deep targets. We understand where their ISIS vulnerabilities are in a number of areas of the country. I agree with General Petraeus about wanting to make sure we do not appear to be part of the blunt Shia militia Iraqi security force instrument of Prime Minister Maliki going after the wider Sunni Arab community. But we can develop the intelligence. We have good targets right now that I think we could hit in Nineveh province and in Anbar. And I think that's where we should begin.
What about boots on the ground?
I think combat forces are not required, but I think advisory elements in command control centers, I think providing some special operations forces to partner with select Iraqi units as advisors in order to make sure we've got the precise intelligence, and we only enable the targeting that is going after the ISIS elements.
Deb Amos, I want to turn back to you there in Erbil in Iraq. We heard from your colleague, Leila Fadel, who's also there in Erbil yesterday, that one of the problems now is that this divide that has always existed is so deep between the Shia and the Sunni that the Shia in Baghdad, for instance, are so petrified of being killed by the Sunni militants that are moving on that even if they wanted to move away from Maliki, they're too afraid at this point. Just talk a little bit about what has to happen now to sort of ease that divide.
Boy, it takes a very, very wise politician to be able to get that message out, and we have not seen that yet. The second problem is that there has been an uptick in sectarian killings on both sides mm-hmm. of the line, and that is what ignited the Iraqi civil war in 2004-5-6. And we are not at a point yet where any political leaders have come out to calm the situation. Quite the contrary. And that is part of the problem here.
Well, we did see religious leaders ask for calm among the Shia, but then we saw the videos coming out of the ISIS organization. Looked like wholesale slaughter. And what we're hearing is that people are just petrified, as they would be with a militant group marching on them.
And we have had the most influential figure of the Shia community, Ayatollah Sistani, making a ruling calling for people to join with the government against what is happening in the north. We've also had the chief Sunni religious leader essentially saying the same thing but in the other direction, that this is not about ISIS, this is about the Sunni community who does not want to live under barrel bombs, very emotional public speech a few days ago. And so the rhetoric from the top leaders are leading us into some very, very rough sectarian waters.
That's NPR's Deborah Amos joining us from Erbil, Iraq. We're also speaking with a number of other NPR correspondents and experts as we wait for the president. If you're just tuning in, this is special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Jeremy Hobson along with Robin Young. We're waiting for President Obama to make a statement on Iraq. The expectation is that he is going to announce more U.S. involvement in the crisis in Iraq, potentially 100 Green Berets being sent there in some sort of advisory capacity. Tom Bowman, as we wait, and I know you've got a television in front of you, too, as you're watching to see. So, again, we may have to cut you off as President Obama emerges at the podium. But let's pick up on what Deb just said. She was talking about ISIS and how much of this really is ISIS and how much of this is just Sunnis and Baathists in Iraq that are fighting the Shiite government.
Well, some of this clearly, you know, are old Baathists from the Saddam era. Some of them are tribal sheikhs, they believe, that are, if not working closely with ISIS, are kind of looking the other way while they do what they do over there. So, and again, this, we've been saying this repeatedly, this is a political issue that you have to reach out to all elements of your society. You can't only focus on your one group, as Maliki has done. And you can send 100 Green Berets, you can send 10,000 Green Berets over there, and most people will tell you it's not going to really do much until you solve these political issues in Iraq.
So why is President Obama going to send, it looks like, 100 Green Berets over? Do they believe it's going to do something?
Again, this is sort of a brush fire, I think they see. So they have to kind of put the fire out before they deal with some of these larger issues. How do you build a better fire department? So I think that's what's going on now, that they can't see Baghdad overrun. You have 5,000 people in the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. They've already sent Marines to shore up security there. Others are on standby to provide airfields to get ready to move Americans out if need be. The last thing they want to see is ISIS start moving south to Baghdad, and then they have a real crisis on their hand from the American standpoint of just getting those Americans out. So I think that's clearly what's going on right now. It's a short-term effort to try to stop ISIS from moving south.
Tom Bowman, and look, we are awaiting President Obama's statement on Iraq. It's a very important moment, so we feel it's important to stick with it. And we've certainly learned a lot. We've gone over a lot of ground while we're waiting. But Ron Elving, and I want to put you on the spot. But as Washington editor there, you know, president first supposed to speak at 12:30 East Coast time, then 1:15. We're now at about 26 minutes past the hour. What do you think is going on? Such an important statement, obviously, you know, an important individual, and we want to respect his need for time. But having said that, what do you think is going on that is holding up something that he knows that so many people are waiting to hear?
Robin, I think that's a highly legitimate question to ask at this point. A lot of people have tuned in starting almost an hour ago, having been told the president was going to speak. A great number of people want to hear what he has to say. And so for this to have taken quite so long does begin to raise questions, not just about the communications operation that apparently had misinformation about when we should expect the president, but also about just what is being decided. Mm-hmm. We were told just about an hour ago, just before 12:30, that the president was still meeting with his national security team in the Situation Room, the famous room deep underground in the White House, where the most momentous decisions about war and peace are made, the room where we have seen famously pictured in movies, but mm-hmm. also in moments such as the moment when the SEALs were breaking in on Osama bin Laden. And that is a very special place in the White House and reserved for the gravest of moments. So if the president has been in the Situation Room with his National Security Council and they are continuing their discussion well past the time when the president was supposedly going to come out and talk to us, presumably that is not still now continuing, because we have actually seen an aide come out and put water on the podium and other things that indicate that we may in fact see the president. But it does raise questions about just how much of a crisis atmosphere there is in the White House over this at the moment.
Or maybe they just, you know, couldn't get somebody on the line that they thought they could talk to at the last minute before coming out to speak.
Well, the other thing, too, if I could quickly add, he may be talking to regional leaders about what he plans to do. He may be talking to them, maybe talking to Maliki about the way ahead and what has to be done. So I don't think he's just sitting there and with his feet up on the desk. He could very well be doing some important phone calls or reaching out to the Hill or so forth.
Jim Walsh, again, expert in international security at MIT. He's with us here in the studio. You're nodding vigorously.
Yes. We talked before about reaching out to former presidents and other policy officials. At the top of that list is reaching out to leaders in the region. You know, one of the principles of diplomacy is no surprises. So he doesn't want to make a speech where there seems to be a change in U.S. policy or principles enunciated that lead to further action without Saudi Arabia, even Iran.
Iran, is that included? Do you think he'd be reaching out to Rouhani?
He hasn't picked up the phone and called Rouhani, but I'm sure that there are communications that will be passed on to all the players. You don't want surprises here, and that goes for the Iraqis on the ground as well.
And which players in the region would not be interested in U.S. Sending additional forces in?
Well, I think for many, particularly on the Sunni side, the Saudi Arabias of the world, there's a real division here, right? Part of what's happened is the Saudis and the Qataris funded extremist groups in Syria. Some of these funds and weapons may have gotten to ISIS at some point. Ideologically, they're closer to them than the Shia, certainly, right? Because Saudi Arabia is in a great rivalry with Iran. So I think this puts some of the Sunni leaders in somewhat of a pickle.
Okay. Well, as we wait, again, we are waiting for President Obama. We want to go to Lebanon. Jordan. Rami Khoury, who is editor-at-large of the Daily Star. We usually speak to you in Beirut, Lebanon, but now in Jordan. Rami Khoury, it's a funky phone line, but that's okay, because we really want to get your thoughts on this. What can you just first of all tell us how the region is expecting this to unfold?
Well, there isn't a single sentiment that defines the whole region. Mm-hmm. You have two basic divisions. You have a division between different groups in the region. Some of them want the Americans to attack or do something to help stem ISIS, and others who don't want any American military involvement. And you also have a big, big gap that continues to define the Arab world, which is the gap between leaders and people. And most governments do not clearly articulate the sentiments of the public opinion in all cases, because there's no democratic mechanisms to have citizen sentiments represented by their governments, because they're not democratic governments. So you'll hear a lot of different views. For instance, the Saudis telling the Americans not to attack in Iraq, but many Saudis privately funding some of the Islamist forces in Syria and Iraq. And these kind of contradictions really define the whole Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Rami Khoury again in Jordan. But are people watching? You know, is there a sense of expectation where you are as well?
Oh, yes, there's a sense of great fear. I was in Beirut yesterday where I live, and I'm in Jordan, Amman. Today I was in Qatar the last weekend, and there's real concern all around the region about the implications for these kinds of movements like ISIS. And it's not just this small group of ISIS fighters, but that there are seems to be millions of discontented citizens in Iraq and Syria and in the Gulf and other places who support some of these groups for various reasons, or at least put up with them. And, you know, the real dilemma, the ugly dilemma, is that so many Iraqis in northwestern Iraq welcomed the arrival of ISIS. They didn't fight them. They welcomed mm-hmm. them in because they thought maybe they would be better than the existing government in Baghdad. So you have this terrible situation of mass discontent, which leads to strange behavior of supporting groups of killers and thugs like ISIS and people like that. But there's serious concern all around the region about what this is going to lead to. And if these groups now control territory, they have oil, they have...
And Robbie, we got to stop you there because the president is coming to the podium.
We've been meeting regularly to review the situation since ISIL, a terrorist organization that operates in Iraq and Syria, made advances inside of Iraq. As I said last week, ISIL poses a threat to the Iraqi people, to the region, and to U.S. interests. So today I want to provide you an update on how we're responding to the situation. First, we are working to secure our embassy and personnel operating inside of Iraq. As president, I have no greater priority than the safety of our men and women serving overseas. So I've taken some steps to relocate some of our embassy personnel, and we've sent reinforcements to better secure our facilities. Second, at my direction, we have significantly increased our intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets so that we've got a better picture of what's taking place inside of Iraq. And this will give us a greater understanding of what ISIL is doing, where it's located, and how we might support efforts to counter this threat. Third, the United States will continue to increase our support to Iraqi security forces. We're prepared to create joint operation centers in Baghdad and northern Iraq to share intelligence and coordinate planning to confront the terrorist threat of ISIL. Through our new Counterterrorism Partnership Fund, we're prepared to work with Congress to provide additional equipment. We have had advisors in Iraq through our embassy, and we're prepared to send a small number of additional American military advisors, up to 300, to assess how we can best train, advise, and support Iraqi security forces going forward. American forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq, but we will help Iraqis as they take the fight to terrorists who threaten the Iraqi people, the region, and American interests as well. Fourth, in recent days, we've positioned additional U.S. military assets in the region. Because of our increased intelligence resources, we're developing more information about potential targets associated with ISIL. And going forward, we will be prepared to take targeted and precise military action if and when we determine that the situation on the ground requires it. If we do, I will consult closely with Congress and leaders in Iraq and in the region. I want to emphasize, though, that the best and most effective response to a threat like ISIL will ultimately involve partnerships where local forces, like Iraqis, take the lead. Finally, the United States will lead a diplomatic effort to work with Iraqi leaders and the countries in the region to support stability in Iraq. At my direction, Secretary Kerry will depart this weekend for meetings in the Middle East and Europe, where he'll be able to consult with our allies and partners. And just as all Iraqi's neighbors must respect Iraq's territorial integrity, all of Iraq's neighbors have a vital interest in ensuring that Iraq does not descend into civil war or become a safe haven for terrorists. Above all, Iraqi leaders must rise above their differences and come together around a political plan for Iraq's future. Shia, Sunni, Kurds, all Iraqis must have confidence that they can advance their interests and aspirations through the political process rather than through violence. National unity meetings have to go forward to build consensus across Iraq's different communities. Now that the results of Iraq's recent election has been certified, a new parliament should convene as soon as possible. The formation of a new government will be an opportunity to begin a genuine dialogue and forge a government that represents the legitimate interests of all Iraqis. Now, it's not the place for the United States to choose Iraq's leaders. It is clear, though, that only leaders that can govern with an inclusive agenda are going to be able to truly bring the Iraqi people together and help them through this crisis. Meanwhile, the United States will not pursue military options that support one sect inside of Iraq at the expense of another. There's no military solution inside of Iraq, certainly not one that is led by the United States. But there is an urgent need for an inclusive political process, a more capable Iraqi security force, and counterterrorism efforts that deny groups like ISIL a safe haven. In closing, recent days have reminded us of the deep scars left by America's war in Iraq. Alongside the loss of nearly 4,500 American patriots, many veterans carry the wounds of that war and will for the rest of their lives. Here at home, Iraq sparked vigorous debates and intense emotions in the past, and we've seen some of those debates resurface. But what's clear from the last decade is the need for the United States to ask hard questions before we take action abroad, particularly military action. So the most important question we should all be asking, the issue that we have to keep front and center, the issue that I keep front and center, is what is in the national security interests of the United States of America. As Commander-in-Chief, that's what I stay focused on. As Americans, that's what all of us should be focused on. And going forward, we will continue to consult closely with Congress. We will keep the American people informed. We will remain vigilant, and we will continue to do everything in our power to protect the security of the United States and the safety of the American people. So with that, I'm going to take a couple of questions. I'll start with Colleen McCain-Nelson of The Wall Street Journal.
Thank you, Mr. President. Do you have any confidence in Prime Minister Maliki at this point, and can Maliki bring political stability to Iraq?
As I said, it's not our job to choose Iraq's leaders. Part of what our patriots fought for during many years in Iraq was the right and the opportunity for Iraqis to determine their own destiny and choose their own leaders. But I don't think there's any secret that right now, at least, there is deep divisions between Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish leaders. And as long as those deep divisions continue or worsen, it's going to be very hard for an Iraqi central government to direct an Iraqi military to deal with these threats. And so we've consulted with Prime Minister Maliki, and we've said that to him privately. We've said it publicly, that whether he is Prime Minister or any other leader aspires to lead the country, that it has to be an agenda in which Sunni, Shia, and Kurd all feel that they have the opportunity to advance their interests through the political process. And we've seen over the last 2 years, actually dating back to 2008-2009, but I think worse over the last 2 years, the sense among Sunnis that their interests were not being served, that legislation that had been promised around, for example, de-Ba'athification had been stalled. I think that you hear similar complaints that the government in Baghdad has not sufficiently reached out to some of the tribes and been able to bring them in to a process that gives them a sense of being part of a unity government or a single nation state, and that has to be worked through. Part of the reason why we saw better equipped Iraqi security forces with larger numbers not be able to hold contested territory against ISIL probably reflects that lack of a sense of commitment on the part of Sunni communities to work with Baghdad, and that has to be fixed if we're going to get through this crisis. Jim Acosta.
Mr. Thank you, Mr. President. Americans may look at this decision that you're making today as a sneak preview of coming attractions, that the number of advisors that you're planning to send in may just be the beginning of a boots-on-the-ground scenario down the road. Why is Iraq's civil war in the national security interests of the United States, and are you concerned about the potential for mission creep?
I think we always have to guard against mission creep. So let me repeat what I've said in the past. American combat troops are not going to be fighting in Iraq again. We do not have the ability to simply solve this problem by sending in tens of thousands of troops and committing the kinds of blood and treasure that has already been expended in Iraq. Ultimately, this is something that is going to have to be solved by the Iraqis. It is in our national security interests not to see an all-out civil war inside of Iraq, not just for humanitarian reasons, but because that ultimately can be destabilizing throughout the region, and in addition to having strong allies there that we are committed to protecting, obviously, issues like energy and global energy markets continues to be important. We also have an interest in making sure that we don't have a safe haven that continues to grow for ISIL and other extremist jihadist groups who could use that as a base of operations for planning and targeting ourselves, our personnel overseas, and eventually the homeland. And you know, if they accumulate more money, they accumulate more ammunition, more military capability, larger numbers, that poses great dangers not just to allies of ours like Jordan, which is very close by, but it also poses you know, a great danger potentially to Europe and ultimately the United States. We have already seen inside of Syria that or groups like ISIL that right now are fighting with other extremist groups or an Assad regime that was non-responsive to a Sunni majority there, that has attracted more and more jihadists or would-be jihadists, some of them from Europe. They then start traveling back to Europe, and that over time can create a cadre of terrorists that could harm us. So we have humanitarian interests in preventing bloodshed. We have strategic interests in stability in the region. We have counterterrorism interests. All those have to be addressed. The initial effort for us to get situational awareness through the reconnaissance and surveillance that we've already done, coupled with some of our best people on the ground doing assessments of exactly what the situation is, starting, by the way, with the perimeter around Baghdad and making sure that that's not overrun, that's a good investment for us to make. But that does not foreshadow a larger commitment of troops to actually fight in Iraq. That would not be effective in meeting the core interests that we have.
Just very quickly, do you wish you had left a residual force in Iraq? Any regrets about that decision in 2011?
Well, keep in mind, that wasn't a decision made by me. That was a decision made by the Iraqi government. We offered a modest residual force to help continue to train and advise Iraqi security forces. We had a core requirement, which we require in any situation where we have U.S. troops overseas, and that is that they are provided immunity at the since they are being invited by the sovereign government there, so that if, for example, they end up acting in self-defense, if they are attacked find themselves in a tough situation, that they're not somehow hauled before a foreign court. That's a core requirement that we have for U.S. troop presence anywhere. The Iraqi government and Prime Minister Maliki declined to provide us that immunity. And so I think it is important, though, to recognize that despite that decision, that we have continued to provide them with very intensive advice and support, and have continued throughout this process over the last 5 years to not only offer them our assistance militarily, but we've also continued to urge the kinds of political compromises that we think are ultimately necessary in order for them to have a functioning multi-sectarian democracy inside the country. Juliet Alper.
You just mentioned Syria a moment ago. Yeah. The United States has been slow to provide significant weapons and training directly to the Syrian opposition. Has the expansion of the Syria war into Iraq changed your mind about the type of weapons and training you are now willing to give the opposition there? Is that what prompted Secretary Kerry to say of Syria, we are augmenting our assistance in significant ways, and can you elaborate on what you are doing now that you weren't doing before?
You know, that that assessment about the dangers of what was happening in Syria have existed since the very beginning of the Syrian civil war. The question has never been whether we thought this was a serious problem. The question has always been, is there the capacity of moderate opposition on the ground to absorb and counteract extremists that it might have been pouring in, as well as an Assad regime supported by Iran and Russia that outmanned them and was ruthless. And so we have consistently provided that opposition with support. Oftentimes the challenge is if you have former farmers or teachers or pharmacists who now are taking up opposition against a battle-hardened regime with support from external actors that have a lot at stake, how quickly can you get them trained? How effective are you able to mobilize them? And you know, that continues to be a challenge. And even before the situation that we saw with ISIL going into Iraq, we had already tried to maximize what we can do to support a moderate opposition that not only can counteract the brutality of Assad, but also can make sure that in the minds of Sunnis, they don't think that their only alternative is either Mr. Assad or extremist groups like ISIL or al-Nusra.
And can you speak to what you might be doing differently, as the Secretary of State alluded to?
Well, I think that the key to both Syria and Iraq is going to be a combination of what happens inside the country, working with moderate Syrian opposition, working with an Iraqi government that is inclusive, and us laying down a more effective counterterrorism platform that gets all the countries in the region pulling in the same direction. And I alluded to this in the West Point speech. This is I talked about it today with respect to the Counterterrorism Partnership Fund. There's going to be a long-term problem in this region in which we have to build and partner with countries that are committed to our interests, our values, and at the same time, we have immediate problems with terrorist organizations that may be advancing. And rather than try to play whack-a-mole wherever these terrorist organizations may pop up, what we have to do is to be able to build effective partnerships, make sure that they have capacity. Some of the assets that have been devoted solely to Afghanistan over the last decade, we've got to shift to make sure that we have coverage in the Middle East and North Africa. You look at a country like Yemen, a very impoverished country, and one that has its own sectarian or ethnic divisions. We do have a committed partner in President Hadi and his government, and we have been able to help to develop their capacities without putting large numbers of U.S. troops on the ground. At the same time as we've got enough CT or counterterrorism capabilities that we're able to go after folks that might try to hit our embassy or might be trying to export terrorism into Europe or the United States. And looking at how we can create more of those models is going to be part of the solution in dealing with both Syria and Iraq. But in order for us to do that, we still need to have actual governments on the ground that we can partner with and that we've got some confidence are going to pursue the political policies of inclusiveness in Yemen, for example, a wide-ranging national dialogue that took a long time but helped to give people a sense that there is a legitimate political outlet for grievances that they may have. Peter Mayer.
Thank you, sir. Going back to where you see Prime Minister al-Maliki playing a role at this point, you said that it's a time to rise above differences, that there's a need for a more inclusive government. Is he a unifier, and how much clout does the United States ultimately have with any of the leadership in Iraq at this point, really?
Well, we still provide them significant assistance. I think they recognize that, unlike some other players in the region, we don't have territorial ambitions in their country. We're not looking to control their assets or their energy. We want to make sure that we're vindicating the enormous effort and sacrifice that was made by our troops in giving them an opportunity to build a stable, inclusive society that can prosper and deliver for the basic needs and aspirations of the Iraqi people. And at the same time, they are a sovereign country. They have their own politics. And what we have tried to do is to give them our best advice about how they can solve their political problems. Now that they are in crisis, we are indicating to them that there's not going to be a simple military solution to this issue. If you start seeing the various groups inside of Iraq simply go to their respective corners, then it is almost certain that Baghdad and the central government will not be able to control huge chunks of their own country. The only way they can do that is if there are credible Sunni leaders, both at the national level and at the local level, who have confidence that a Shia majority, that the Kurds, that all those folks are committed to a fair and just governance of the country. Right now, that doesn't exist. There's too much suspicion. There's too much mistrust. And the good news is that an election took place in which, despite all this mistrust, despite all this frustration, despite all this anger, you still had millions of Iraqis turn out, in some cases in very dangerous circumstances. You now have a court that has certified those elections, and you have a constitutional process to advance government formation. So far, at least, the one bit of encouraging news that we've seen inside of Iraq is that all the parties have said they continue to be committed to choosing a leadership and a government through the existing constitutional order. So what you're seeing, I think, is as the prospects of civil war heighten, many Iraqi leaders stepping back and saying, let's not plunge back into the abyss. Let's see if we can resolve this politically. But they don't have a lot of time. And you have a group like ISIL that is doing everything that it can to descend the country back into chaos. And so one of the messages that we had for Prime Minister Maliki, but also for the Speaker of the House and the other leadership inside of Iraq is get going on this government formation. It'll make it a lot easier for them to shape a military strategy. It'll also make it possible for us to partner much more effectively than we can currently.
Given the Prime Minister's track record, is he a unifier? Can he play that role when, after what we've seen play out over the last couple of weeks is brought into play?
I think the test is before him and other Iraqi leaders as we speak. Right now, they can make a series of decisions. Regardless of what's happened in the past, right now is a moment where the fate of Iraq hangs in the balance. And the test for all of them is going to be whether they can overcome the mistrust, the deep sectarian divisions, in some cases just political opportunism, and say, this is bigger than any one of us, and we've got to make sure that we do what's right for the Iraqi people. And that's a challenge. That's not something that the United States can do for them. That's not something, by the way, that the United States armed forces can do for them. We can provide them the space. We can provide them the tools. But ultimately, they're going to have to make those decisions. In the meantime, my job is to make sure that American personnel there are safe, that we are consulting with the Iraqi security forces, that we're getting a better assessment of what's on the ground, and that we're recognizing the dangers of ISIL over the long term and developing the kinds of comprehensive counterterrorism strategies that we're going to need to deal with this issue. And that's going to involve some short-term responses to make sure that ISIL is not obtaining capacity to endanger us directly or our allies and partners. But it also is going to require some long-term strategies as well, because part of what we've seen with respect to ISIL is a broader trend that I talked about at West Point, rather than a single network, a discrete network of terrorists. This fluid combination of hardened terrorists, disaffected local leadership, and where there's vacuums, they're filling it and creating the potential for serious danger for all concerned. So, all right? Thank you very much.
Any words on what you were willing to do
with respect,
are you willing to work with them?
Our view is that Iran can play a constructive role if it is helping to send the same message to the Iraqi government that we're sending, which is that Iraqi only holds together if it's inclusive, and that if the interests of Sunni, Shia, and Kurd are all respected. If Iran is coming in solely as an armed force on behalf of the Shia, and if it is framed in that fashion, then that probably worsens the situation and the prospect for government formation that would actually be constructive over the long term.
What's your sense of that right now?
Well, I think that just as Iraq's leaders have to make decisions, I think Iran has heard from us. We've indicated to them that it is important for them to avoid steps that might encourage the kind of sectarian splits that might lead to civil war. The one thing that I think is has to be emphasized, we have deep differences with Iran across the board on a whole host of issues. Obviously, what's happened in Syria, in part, is the result of Iran coming in hot and heavy on one side. Iran obviously should consider the fact that if its view of the region is solely through sectarian frames, they could find themselves fighting in a whole lot of places, and that's probably not good for the Iranian economy or the Iranian people over the long term either. I suspect there are folks in Iran who recognize that. A Iraq in chaos on their borders is probably not in their interests. But old habits die hard, and we'll have to see whether they can take what I think would be a more promising path over the next several days. All right? Thank you very much, everybody.
This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston. We've been listening to President Obama outlining his plan for Iraq, the president speaking in the White House briefing room, taking a question there about Iran, earlier confirming the expectation that began floating earlier today that he'll send up to 300 military advisors to Iraq, but just to train and help in a local response to the militant extremist Sunni uprising known as ISIS, although the president called it ISIL, a different way of saying the same thing. He also said he'll be sending Secretary of State John Kerry as soon as this weekend to work the diplomatic end of the crisis. When asked about mission creep, the president said American combat troops are not going to be fighting in Iraq again. He actually said that twice today. Again, this is special coverage of the president's press conference from NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and we're joined by NPR reporters around the globe as well as experts. And I want to go first to NPR Washington editor Ron Elving. Ron, your thoughts on what the president had to say.
The president had two themes here. He said, we cannot resolve the situation in Iraq by committing tens of thousands of lives and treasure, as we did in the past decade. He said that twice, as you noted. He also said, almost in the same breath, our national security is not to see an all-out civil war in Iraq. And he talked about all the different ways that an ISIL or ISIS conquest in that part of the world would be bad for American security, bad for our allies, bad for energy, that is to say the availability of energy coming from that oil-rich region, the money and resources that could give to a terror cadre, as he described it, the volunteers who might be funneled into actions against our country and other countries. And he said it was clearly not in our interest to see Baghdad overrun, so he spoke of some short-term measures that we would do to prevent that and a longer-term strategy that would involve other countries to try to save the Iraqi state in some recognizable condition.
But he also said that putting Iraq back together is not something that the United States can do for them. Deb Amos, let me go to you briefly. In Erbil, Iraq, NPR international correspondent Deb Amos, what did you make of what he had to say?
I thought that he very clearly came back to this theme of politics, that this kind of terrorism that we've seen in the region is really about politics. He linked Iraq and Syria, and he did it a number of times tonight. But I thought that he spoke very firmly about Sunni complaints here in Iraq. He talked about there needs to be a credible Sunni leadership who have confidence that there's a fair and just country. Right now, that doesn't exist. He talked about their discontent and that it has to be addressed in Baghdad. He also spoke to Iran, and he connected this to Syria. He said Iran was coming in on one side in Syria, and that complicated matters there. He made a couple of very sophisticated points about both conflicts, comparing them and linking them.
Yeah. Tom Bowman, I want to go to you, a Pentagon reporter in Washington, listening to all of this, I'm sure. I'd love your thoughts, but also, what you observed. But also, one line jumped out. He said the U.S. will not pursue options that support one sect over another. Isn't that a hard needle to thread if, in fact, the advisors are going to support the Sunni the Shia army over the Sunni militants?
Well, I think what he's saying is they're not going in there to support, necessarily one faction in the country, but basically they're going in there to go after ISIS, or ISIL, as he said. And what jumped out at me is, you know, we thought it'd be 100 or so trainers. It's up to 300, he said. Yeah. They're also going to set up a joint operations center in Baghdad in northern Iraq. If they're providing more surveillance, intelligence, and reconnaissance to the country, those folks can go in there and help you look at targets. Interestingly, too, some people
thought
targets—
Sorry, Tom, we got to wrap it up right there, but stand by. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman in Washington. This is special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston of the president's statement. I'm Jeremy Hobson.